Chapter 29, The Beginnings, the Rise, and the Divisions of Christianity. First, Judea at the Christian era. Second, the teachings of Jesus of Nazareth. Third, the new universal religions. Fourth, the crucifixion of Jesus of Nazareth. Fifth, doctrines added to the teachings of Jesus. Sixth, the struggles and persecutions of Christianity. Seventh, Constantine the Great. Eighth, the establishment of official Christianity. Ninth, the map of Europe in A.D. 500. Tenth, the salvation of learning by Christianity. First, before we can understand the qualities of Christianity, which must now play a large part in our history, and which opened men's eyes to fresh aspects of the possibility of a unified world, we must go back some centuries and tell of the condition of affairs in Palestine and Syria, in which countries Christianity arose. We've already told the main facts about the origin of the Jewish nation and tradition, about the diaspora, about the fundamentally scattered nature of Jewry, even from the beginning, and the gradual development of the idea of one just God ruling the earth and bound by a special promise to preserve and bring to honor the Jewish people. The Jewish idea was and is a curious combination of theological breadth and an intense racial patriotism. The Jews looked for a special savior, a messiah, who was to redeem mankind by the agreeable process of restoring the fabulous glories of David and Solomon, and bringing the whole world at last under the benevolent but firm Jewish heel. As the political power of the Semitic peoples declined, as Carthage followed Tyre into the darkness and Spain became a Roman province, this dream grew and spread. There can be little doubt that the scattered Phoenicians in Spain and Africa, and throughout the Mediterranean, speaking as they did a language closely akin to Hebrew, and being deprived of their authentic political rights, became proselytes to Judaism. For phases of vigorous proselytism alternated with phases of exclusive jealousy in Jewish history. On one occasion, the Idumeans, being conquered, were all forcibly made Jews. There were Arab tribes who were Jews in the time of Muhammad, and a Turkish people who were mainly Jews in South Russia in the 9th century. Judaism is indeed the reconstructed political ideal of many shattered peoples, mainly Semitic. It's to the Phoenician contingent and to Aramaean accessions in Babylon that the financial and commercial tradition of the Jews is to be ascribed. But as a result of these coalescences and assimilations, almost everywhere in the towns throughout the Roman Empire and far beyond it in the East, Jewish communities traded and flourished and were kept in touch through the Bible and through a religious and educational organization. The main part of Jewry never was in Judea and had never come out of Judea. Manifestly, this intercommunicating series of Judaized communities had very great financial and political facilities. They could assemble resources, they could stir up, they could allay. They were neither so abundant nor so civilized as the still more widely diffused Greeks, but they had a tradition of greater solidarity. Greek was hostile to Greek. Jew stood by Jew. Wherever a Jew went, he found men of like mind and like tradition with himself. He could get shelter, food, loans, and legal help. And by reason of this solidarity, rulers had everywhere to take account of this people as a help, as a source of loans, or as a source of trouble. So it is that the Jews have persisted as a people, while Hellenism has become a universal light for mankind. We can't tell here in any detail the history of that smaller part of Jewry that lived in Judea. These Jews had returned to their old position of danger. Again, they were seeking peace in, so to speak, the middle of a highway. In the old time, they'd been between Syria and Assyria to the north and Egypt to the south. Now they had the Seleucids to the north and the Ptolemies to the south, and when the Seleucids went, then down came the Roman power upon them. The independence of Judea was always a qualified and precarious thing. The reader must go to the Antiquities and the Wars of the Jews of Flavius Josephus, a copious, tedious, and maddeningly patriotic writer, to learn of the succession of their rulers, of their high priest monarchs, and of the Maccabeans, the Herods, and the like. These rulers were for the most part of the ordinary Eastern type, cunning, treacherous, and blood-stained. Thrice Jerusalem was taken, and twice the temple was destroyed. It was the support of the far more powerful diaspora that prevented the little country from being wiped out altogether until 70 AD, when Titus, the adopted son and successor of the Emperor Vespasian, after a siege that ranks in bitterness and horror with that of Tyre and Carthage, took Jerusalem and destroyed city and temple altogether. He did this in an attempt to destroy Jewry, but indeed he made Jewry stronger by destroying its one sensitive and vulnerable point. Throughout a history of 5 centuries of war and civil commotion between the return from captivity and the destruction of Jerusalem, certain constant features of the Jew persisted. He remained obstinately monotheistic. He'd have none other gods but the one true God. In Rome, as in Jerusalem, he stood out manfully against the worship of any god Caesar, and to the best of his ability he held to his covenants with his God. No graven images could enter Jerusalem. Even the Roman standards with their eagles had to stay outside. 2 divergent lines of thought are traceable in Jewish affairs during these 500 years. On the right, so to speak, are the high and narrow Jews, the Pharisees, very orthodox, very punctilious, upon even the minutest details of the law, intensely patriotic and exclusive. Jerusalem, on one occasion, fell to the Seleucid monarch Antiochus IV, because the Jews wouldn't defend it on the Sabbath day, when it is forbidden to work. And it was because the Jews made no effort to destroy his siege train on the Sabbath that Pompey the Great was able to take Jerusalem. But against these narrow Jews were pitted the broad Jews, the Jews of the left, who were Hellenizers, among whom are to be ranked the Sadducees, who didn't believe in immortality. These latter Jews, the broad Jews, were all more or less disposed to mingle with and assimilate themselves to the Greeks and Hellenized peoples about them. They were ready to accept proselytes, and so to share God and his promise with all mankind. But what they gained in generosity they lost in rectitude. They were the worldlings of Judea. We've already noted how the Hellenized Jews of Egypt lost their Hebrew and had to have their Bible translated into Greek. In the reign of Tiberius Caesar, a great teacher arose out of Judea who was to liberate the intense realization of the righteousness and unchallengeable oneness of God and of man's moral obligation to God, which was the strength of Orthodox Judaism, from that greedy and exclusive narrowness with which it was so extraordinarily intermingled in the Jewish mind. This was Jesus of Nazareth, the seed rather than the founder of Christianity. Second, the audience to which this book will first be presented will be largely an audience of Christians, with perhaps a sprinkling of Jewish readers, and the former at least will regard Jesus of Nazareth as being much more than a human teacher, and his appearance in the world not as a natural event in history, but as something of a supernatural sort, interrupting and changing that steady development of life towards a common consciousness and a common will, which we have hitherto been tracing in this book. But these persuasions, dominant as they are in Europe and America, are nevertheless not the persuasions of all men, or of the great majority of mankind, and we are writing this outline of the story of life with as complete an avoidance of controversial matter as may be. We're trying to write as if this book was to be read as much by Hindus or Muslims or Buddhists as by Americans and Western Europeans. We shall therefore hold closely to the apparent facts and avoid, without any disputation or denial, the theological interpretations that have been imposed upon them. We shall tell what men have believed about Jesus of Nazareth, but him we shall treat as being what he appeared to be, a man, just as a painter must needs paint him as a man. The documents that testify to his acts and teachings we shall treat as ordinary human documents. If the light of divinity shine through our recital, we will neither help nor hinder it. This is what we've already done in the case of Buddha, and what we shall do later with Mohammed. About Jesus we have to write not theology, but history, and our concern is not with the spiritual and theological significance of his life, but with its effects upon the political and everyday life of men.